Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Well, we have two Wisconsin researchers joining us now to talk about the possibilities of bioproducts, plant-based materials, and some of the challenges that limit the industry. A couple of guests. William Banholzer is a research professor and honorary fellow in the chemistry department at UW-Madison. He's formerly a chemical engineer and executive vice president and chief technology officer at Dow Chemical Company, and he is a senior advisor at the Wisconsin Energy Institute. William Banholzer, welcome. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Larry. It's welcome to be here.
Yeah, I'm great to have you with us. With us as well, Kieran Furlong is a senior fellow at COWS at UW-Madison. He has years of experience in bioproduct startups and development, including helping Coca-Cola incorporate bioplastics into their production line. And Kieran, welcome to you as well.
Yes, good morning. Thank you very much, Larry. Great to be here with you.
Thank you very much for joining us. And you can join in too. Join in with your questions or comments about the challenges and complexities of bioproducts. You call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or shoot us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Kieran, let's start with you. You just started in your position at COWS. Tell us a bit about your background and interest in sustainability.
Sure. Yeah, happy to do so. So, I'm a relatively new arrival on campus. Took a position at UW-Madison 2 years ago and then just recently joined the team at COWS. Prior to this, I started my career as a chemical engineer in the chemical industry, but dealt a lot with agribusiness. So the big grain processors, the Cargills and ADMs of the world were my main customers. And I was always interested in, well, what can we grow in the field that we can use as an alternative to what we're pulling out of the ground in terms of oil and natural gas, for example. So after about a decade in the chemical industry, I actually went back to grad school, kind of got plugged into the startup world and joined a small startup doing crazy things with algae in an old ice cream factory in San Francisco as we were trying to make bio-based materials, biofuels, and so on. And that led to a role with another startup based here in Madison, actually, Virent, which brought me to Wisconsin first, where we were looking to direct the technology towards the production of bio-based materials. And, through startups, ended up in the world of venture capital, but I've always really been passionate on finding, how can we apply technology to sustainable solutions for the food we need, the water we need, the energy and shelter, and all the other basic needs of humanity. So
yeah,
that's
really
kind of
cool.
My path.
That's quite a path. Well, Bill, tell us a bit about your research interests and your background as well.
Sure, thanks. So I started as a chemical engineer at General Electric. I did my PhD at the University of Illinois, and I worked on materials for 30 years. I spent 22 years at GE, and then I joined Dow Chemical in 2005 and ran the R&D group, and I also ran the venture capital group. So even as big as Dow was, there are smart people doing a lot of things, startups. So we also invested in small companies looking for alternatives. And I also, people may not recognize, Dow had a $6 billion ag business. So in addition to running the hardcore fossil fuel-derived chemicals, we had an ag business that made everything from seeds to insecticides and so forth. And then in 2014, I joined UW in chemical engineering and chemistry and am trying to bring an industrial perspective to our education. And so that people understand, there's so many things we can do because science has got so many tools now, but how do we sort out what's possible to what's practical? Because in my mind, that's what engineers do, is you separate those two.
Yeah, for sure. Kieran, maybe you want to talk a little bit about more. You want to get more bioproducts on the market and expand that bioeconomy. Why is that so important?
Yeah, so, there's a number of reasons why, personally it was important to me. Like I said, one was the area around environmental sustainability.
And I mean, this goes all the way back to when I was a kid, and people might remember the no CFCs campaigns and the banning of, you know, the propellant that was used in aerosol cans and so on. And that very much kind of got me motivated as a youngster. And then moving on, you know, you start looking at issues like climate change and so on. And there's a myriad of solutions out there. But one of them that I saw was, well, can we grow in a field what we're currently making out of the products coming out of an oil refinery and so on? And I do think there's room for both. But I just thought it's also another way to, you know, further develop the agricultural products market and so on. You know, there's a lot of discussion around, are we short of land, or are we going to have food versus fuel type debates? And I imagine we'll get into some of that. But the reality is that farmers are always looking for, you know, new markets and new margins for their business. So I see it as kind of that there's a two sides to it there. One is, will this help us to have a lighter footprint on the earth? And the other one is this another way for farmers and for the whole industry that depends on the output of agriculture to find new products that we can all use?
Yeah, and maybe you could give an example or two of some possibilities with bioproducts. What kinds of things are we talking about here?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, while I was at Viron, for example, we were working on a very high-profile project with the Coca-Cola company, and that was around having more bio-based content in the packaging that they use for their soda bottles and water bottles and so on. So that's a polymer that's called PET. It's a polyester, but everyone will recognize it. It's the stuff that you see the plastic bottles in the coolers and the convenience stores. And to be able to, you know, look at alternative sources for those kind of materials, and while also ensuring they can be recyclable. That's one great example. You know, imagine if you're taking carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, it gets taken up by a crop in a field, and then you can convert it into that plastic and keep it locked up in that and recycle and reuse that material. You've essentially removed carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and now locked it into a polymer, which is pretty good way of doing some carbon sequestration while you're at it. So that's one example, and it's one that I've spent a lot of time on, is more so the, can we make materials that, you know, kind of are long-lasting versus, you know, something where you're in the biofuel loop, where you're taking stuff out of the atmosphere via a crop and then burning it again to provide energy for, you know, mobility, for example.
Yeah. Bill, what happens to a bioproduct item when a consumer is done with it? You know, let's say recycling a used Coca-Cola bottle versus other products on the market, maybe made with fossil fuels. Are they able to be recycled or broken down in different ways?
Yeah, so I agree with Kieran. I think there's a place for each. My criticism has been, I think we've tried to overextend it to places that didn't make sense. But if you look at the Coke, they call it the plant bottle, where that's the same plastic, and it doesn't, so you wouldn't know that's derived from plant-based or bio-based materials or fossil fuels, because the PET that Kieran mentioned is the same. And so it's just a different way to get to the same end product. And so the same recyclability of that PET, whether it was plant-based or fossil-based, they can happen either way. And I also agree, look, recycle is one of the best things we can do, because then you're recycling and using the same material over and over again versus single use. And that's where a lot of people, you know, struggle with single use plastics. I think the key thing that Kieran mentioned that I try to focus is you need to understand lowering your footprint. You know, how do we make the world sort of more sustainable? And the way we typically do that in a quantitative way is we do something called life cycle analysis, where you look at all of the materials that go into making something, and then how they're used, and then all the waste streams that come off, and then at the end of the use of the product, what do you do with it? And so the classic is, you know, what's better for the environment? I ask my students, you know, a paper bag or a plastic bag, or a glass water bottle, aluminum water bottle, or a plastic water bottle. And so how do you answer that question? Because most people would think, well, paper is better because it's sustainable. It comes from trees. And the reality is, if you do the whole life cycle analysis, there's a lot of chemistry and a lot of waste that goes into making paper. And then when that paper is digested, it decomposes and goes back into the air as CO2. So it doesn't really, have the same carbon reduction that you think, or the chemical effluent reduction that you think, and plastic is actually has a lower footprint than a paper would. You know, the same thing is true of, if you think about the biggest bio-derived product is ethanol. You know, we all buy our gas, and it says, you know, E10 on it. It has 10% ethanol in it that comes from corn. And there's a lot of studies that have been done that shows, you know, it's well-intentioned because it sounds good that, you know, we make our fuel from corn. But if you really look at it, it's not independent. To make corn, you put a lot of fertilizer in the ground. You have to get it to grow. And fertilizer is made from natural gas because you have to make ammonia. And then you've got the tractors that have to go and cut it. And then you have to process it. And then when you do make ethanol, you take all this carbon. And for every 6 carbons that you put into your plant, you only get 2 out as fuel. 4 go up the stack back as CO2. And so if in a life cycle analysis, we'd look at ethanol and say, you know, it's really not having as good impact. It might be at best neutral and maybe negative. But then as a consumer, the other issue is people want to drive their cars. They want their bottles of water. They want some value. And, you know, ethanol is actually an inferior fuel. If you bought a flex fuel car, and I was just at Quick Trip the other day, and I saw, you know, they have E85 fuel at the same price as regular. Well, ethanol has less energy in it. So if you took your 20 miles per gallon car and you put ethanol in it, now you get 14 miles per gallon. So you pay the same, but you don't get to go as far. So from an overall perspective, that's where I think we want to keep in perspective, is how do we make sure that we're doing the best for the world or the country, and not, you know, not confusing, you know, where do we make an impact and where do we not?
Yeah. Jim from Cedarburg emailed and says he heard a researcher discovered a mother plastic polymer from which all others could be made. He wonders if that's true and what's the significance of it. Will it be economically feasible?
Boy, I'm not sure what a mother polymer is. You, Karen?
Well, I mean, I'll attempt an answer. Yeah, I'm not sure what your listener is referring to there specifically. But this, I mean, it's maybe reflecting one of the challenges you have with, you know, our whole economy that's built on the carbon molecule. Okay, so with many of the sources of polymers, or what we typically call the day-to-day use plastics, they will, you know, it's a form of a carbon chain, right? So you've got a bunch of little molecules that you're stringing all together, and that's where you get the polymer, right? You get a number of these different things together. Now, sometimes you're looking at polymers from nature. You know, you've got cellulose, for example. Bill had mentioned the paper industry. So that's all based around natural polymers. And when you have any large carbon molecule, you can break it all the way down, if you like, to its smallest individual building blocks. You can almost get all the way down to, you know, kind of a C1 or one carbon atom type molecules, and then build them back up again as well. How much you do that can have a huge impact on the economics of the end product as well. So there's lots of technologies out there where they're basically saying, hey, we can take a large variety of different, you know, biomasses or even, you know, waste plastics and so on, and essentially digest or degrade them all to get them back to very simple carbon molecules, and then build those back up into the, you know, kind of clean version polymers that we want to use in our packaging, for example. And then there's other approaches where you're trying to not go all the way to that single carbon molecule, but instead, can we just go far enough that we've got something we can work with and then apply some smart chemistry or biochemistry to then convert that into a polymer we'd like to be able to use. And sometimes that can offer an economic advantage or an energy advantage, but a lot of it just depends on, you know, the pathways that you have to go through, how effectively you can scale that up, and what the economics are going to look like at the end of the day. And economics are really, really important when we look at all of these things. You know, Bill has mentioned the biofuels, you know, like ethanol and so on. And obviously, government involvement has been a huge driver in the development and adoption of new technologies in this area. And that's often because, you know, with bio-based materials, whether it's fuels or polymers, you're kind of showing up late to the game, right? And you're trying to insert yourself into something which is already been going for 3 out of the 4 quarters, and be up to speed and able to compete with the industry that's already there. And that can be really, really challenging. And that was one of the things that we faced, you know, that I faced through my career in some of the different companies out of that, including Virant, was you're on the horns of a dilemma. Do we try to make the exact same polymer that's currently in use, that's currently coming out of a petroleum or natural gas feedstock, and be able to drop right in to that very complicated supply chain? Or do we look at doing something different but better, you know, with some kind of improved properties and so on, and then try and convince the existing industry to move over to that new material? And that's a really tricky choice, you know, kind of, you know, bird in the hand versus two in the bush kind of thing.
It is indeed. Well, we're talking about plant-based products in Wisconsin, or maybe for Wisconsin, with our two guests today, Bill Banholzer, research professor and honorary fellow in the chemistry department at UW-Madison, also a senior advisor at the Wisconsin Energy Institute, Karen Furlong, senior fellow at COWS at UW-Madison, lots of years of experience in bioproduct startups and development. Join in with your questions and comments about these challenges and complexities of bioproducts. I hope you have some questions. Give a call, 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Natalie Guyette, our producer today, Tyler Ditter, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at plant-based products in and for Wisconsin with our two guests, Bill Banholzer, research professor, Karen Furlong, senior fellow at COWS at UW-Madison. It's great to have them with us today. Questions for them, give a call at 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And let's take a call. Peter in Waupaca, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Peter. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm looking at building a house, and it's so darn expensive. One of the things I was looking at was using hemp curd as insulation and a wall product. You can make it up to 16 inches deep. You can eliminate the sheeting, the siding, the drywall, the insulation. It's an incredible product. Along with using hemp for clothing, we can replace cotton. It's much more cost effective than cotton. We can
so
use
you're
it
a hemp
for
producer.
Packaging. Yeah, I'm
so
big on hemp.
You're big on hemp. Well, guys, what do you think? Karen, you want to start?
Sure, I can start on that one. Yeah, I mean, and look, this is great. And building, I'm glad to hear you're paying a lot of attention, Peter, to the insulation, because your first role here is to try and save energy from the house. But in terms of using the bio-based materials, I'm glad you've mentioned hemp. Because at the end of the day, you know, I think one of the things that often gets lost in the discussion around agriculture is people focus exclusively on food, not realizing that we grow a lot of fiber with agriculture as well. You've mentioned cotton, for example. Hemp's another great one. You know, you go back to, you know, rope making and sisal twine and all the rest of it. Through history, there's been a lot of fiber. Wool from sheep is seeing a resurgence in the fashion industry as well through, you know, trendy sneakers and everything else. So first of all, I think we need to realize that bio-based fibers have always been with us. In many cases, they offer superior advantages, like just as we're talking about kind of the resurgence of wool, for example. And when it comes to insulation, there's a variety of ways in house building that we're seeing bio-based products being used. I mean, obviously, a lot of homes in this country, most of them are still stick-built, so you're still using lumber for the structure. And then when it comes to the insulation, you've got natural materials, whether it's hemp or cellulose, essentially kind of a paper-type product that's going into insulation. But even with some of the more high-tech insulating materials out there where you're getting the same R value but for a lot less depth, a lot of those are based on polyurethane foams. And interesting, that was actually one of the first bio-based products I worked on almost 20 years ago now, where
essentially you go back to the early 2000s, the U.S. had a glut of soybean oil. You know, protein sales had taken off as the Chinese economy was developing. You know, I always like to say, yeah, they discovered they had enough wealth now to eat more chicken, but they hadn't figured out yet how to Kentucky Fried. So the oil was left behind. But you have a number of companies in the U.S. who are looking at converting that soybean oil into precursors for polyurethane. And that they were successful in that. Now, obviously, a lot of it, again, comes back to that economics. Is that a cost-effective way of doing it? But it's just another example of how, you know, your insulation choices, even if you can go for, you know, the ones that are in their natural form, if you like the hemp, like the cellulose. But some of the, you know, polymer-based insulating materials also can be derived from bio-based materials. And maybe I'll see if Bill wants to weigh in.
Yeah, Bill, you want to weigh in at all?
Sure. I agree 100% with what Kieran just said. The truth is that people just want something accomplished. They want their food not to spoil. They want a garbage bag that doesn't tear. They want, you know, their houses to be insulated. And so they're largely agnostic to how it gets done. But in many cases, biological-derived products are an alternative. And, you know, if you look at the first Henry Ford's first car ran on ethanol, and a lot of our chemical industry started from natural-derived products. So, and today, even the insecticides and stuff, there's a lot of them. So natural fibers have tremendous use throughout. It's just always a question of what is it worth, and is it really a better product, and how much does it cost? And I actually went through an expensive R&D program to use the oil that Kieran mentioned to try to make a chemical, and it ended up that there was two issues. One, while you could do it, so the biological derived oils you could use, it was just too expensive compared to the alternatives. And the bigger issue was there just wasn't enough of it to build a world-scale plant. So today, the chemical plants are huge. And chemical plants are small compared to fuel plants, refineries. And at the end of the day, we would have had to use up a third of the world's oil, bio-derived oil, to be able to make this urethane. And a third of the glycerin that comes off of that oil to be able to make a molecule called propylene oxide. And we had marginal economics to start with. I mean, the plant wasn't really going to pay for itself. But once you start buying up a third of the world's quantity, then, you know, their supply and demand kicks in and the price goes up. And it just wasn't available. So I think a key thing for all of the biological challenges is that you've got to understand your market and you really create value that somebody will pay for. So in business, I always say, you got to know what people want. Obviously, they're not going to pay something they don't want. You also got to know what they'll pay for, because if it's free, people do a lot of stuff. If they got to pay for it, they have to make a value decision. And then you got to decide what they can afford. And you got to have a yes to all of those. And so and when you're going to put these chemical plants cost hundreds of millions to billions of dollars to build, you got to make sure that, you know, you get a return on that. And so if people won't pay you for your product, that's a big issue. And, you know, Kieran mentioned Coke. I had a long discussion with Coke about trying to help them put in more bio-based materials. And they were very – and we had the technology. We were building plants to use it actually to make plastics in Brazil. But they wanted it, but they didn't want to pay any more for it. And it was just fundamentally more expensive. When you have bio – you know, if you think about biomaterials, there's a fundamental problem that you have is that they're not pure. You know, there's a lot of stuff in plants. And so when you're a chemical engineer, the first thing you learn is you don't want impure or contaminated feedstocks, and you don't want impure or contaminated end products. And when you make things out of biomass, you end up with a lot of things you don't want. And so there's a fundamental cost issue. And Coke wanted it because they thought it was, you know, it's good for their image. But at the end of the day, they didn't want to pay anything more for it. So understanding this, you know, what we call the value proposition, how much will it cost and what somebody will pay, makes a big difference. Now, if you're making vaccines, you're making pharmaceuticals, you're making insecticides, you're making very specialty oils that go into health stuff, those are very high-value products. And so there you've got the luxury of being able to use, you know, spend more time purifying feedstocks or having more exotic transformations. But the more commoditized something gets, you know, your garbage bag is a commodity. You know, fuels are a real commodity. That's where you've got to sort of make sure you understand what I'm doing. Is it going to be cost competitive? And do consumers really want it? Will they pay more?
Right. But we should recognize, Bill, that, you know, there are still areas where the commodity is cheaper from a bio-based source. I mean, you've mentioned paper already. We're not making that out of polymers, although I think it was William McDonough's book, Cradle to Cradle, was on plastic pages, which was wonderful when you felt the book. But paper was one. You know, our shower gels and detergents, a lot of those are still coming from, you know, biological oils for background, too. So the economics will drive it, but it's not always an exclusive that the petrol source is cheaper for any given product than the bio source. A lot of that's going to depend.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
John from... Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Bill.
I was going to say, so I don't want to come off anti-bio. I'm just anti-misapplied. And so I'm on the board of directors of a startup out of Wisconsin that's actually making a molecule from a derivative of corn. And it has, but it has, it fits the criteria. It's something you can't make easily from fossil fuels. And it's more cost effective. So when you go into, and this would go into everything from coatings and paints to foams, and there's lots of applications for this molecule. When you go talk to the customers, the PPGs or the Sherwin-Williams or the people who make paints and coatings, we're bringing them a product that they can't get at this cost. So that's a productivity play. You know, you're giving them something that's equivalent or in some cases maybe better, but it saves them money. It's when you go in and say, look, I'm going to make the same water bottle to sell your Coke in, but it's going to cost you more, that you sometimes have to struggle. And so I think there's lots of places where you can make bio-based materials cheaper and better, but they're smaller. They're not, you know, expansive. People can't think we're going to replace all of our garbage bags with bio-derived stuff because of the cost and availability and scale issues.
Right. And hopefully we've addressed Peter's question a little bit, but I think it's a great example of, I mean, I think Bill's point on the historical perspective is really important. And sometimes we'll come back to bio-based materials, which were popular once in the past, and whether through new methods of cultivation or price dynamics in the commodities market, they're becoming attractive again. I mean, one of my favorite examples is just thinking about light, how we light our homes. You know, you go back 200 years, and it was the whaling industry that was supplying our fuel for how we lit our homes, right? You have your lamps with whale oil or whatever else. And then that got nudged sideways as supply became constrained for obvious reasons by Rockefeller and others producing kerosene for kerosene lamps. And that lasted quite a long time. In fact, even in my childhood, there was particular uses in Ireland where I saw kerosene lamps. But that got edged out by electricity, which just was more convenient and cheaper and so on. And so just understanding, well, what's going to happen in, for example, transportation? Will we see a mass electrification of our cars or light vehicles and so on? Or will we need to maintain liquid fuels because of some of the advantages they offer with energy density, pumpability, and so on? It might be a case of, yeah, your car might run on electricity, but will that jet taking you to Florida for your break from the Wisconsin winter, will that fly on electricity, right? So there's going to be different uses as well. But having that historical perspective, I think, is really interesting. And I've always liked to look back at, well, what other technologies and materials were used in the past? Can we dust some of those off and use them again, much like Peter's considering the use of hemp insulation, I think.
Yeah. Barry in Madison has, I think, a comment on another material. Barry, hi. Thanks for calling.
Yes. I'm aware of some research and development that has been going on in India regarding pulverized rice straw for development of biofuels. Do you know anything about that?
You guys familiar with that?
Yeah, so there's the reality is fuel just needs to burn. And as long as it's got carbon, it should burn. Now, the issue with all these processes is, can you make a fuel that is compatible with existing infrastructure, or do we? And in these cases, there, whether it's rice or corn stover, or there was a big push towards cellulosic ethanol. So instead of taking the way we make ethanol today, is we do it the way we make wine. We ferment it, and yeast convert it into alcohol that we then extract and burn. But if you could break down sugars or pulp trees or any of those products, can be broken down and turned into ethanol. The key question comes to how cost effective is it, and is it a does it really have less carbon? So the problem with corn is we put so much fertilizer and everything on it. If you've got a byproduct of like rice hulls or a corn stover, or you can break those down, and you certainly can do it. And it just comes down to, do the plants make economic sense? And for the most part, we've had a lot of, we've had literally tens of billions of dollars in the United States that is about plants. People are trying to do this. They just have shut down because they can't make it cost effectively. And another big issue is biomass has more oxygen in it. So if you think about the size of a chemical refinery, you need about 100 ethanol fermenters to make up for one plant. So there's something we call capital efficiency, the how much dollars do I have to build into a plant to get how much fuel out. And so the problem with rice or any bio-derived product is that it has a lot of oxygen in it. It could be sort of, for every carbon, it has maybe one oxygen and then two hydrogens, whereas natural gas, and they have no oxygen, and they come up with without it. So you're getting a less valuable fuel, and you have to get rid of that oxygen, and that ends up turning into cost. But they're all possible. It's just going to come down to, can you do it cost effectively? Now, what would change this, if the world decided that we are going to tax CO2, that climate change is so problematic, that we need to tax CO2 emissions and put $100 a ton tax on it, then some of these processes will make, their economics would swing in their favor. But, that's a big question. The world doesn't even agree on exchange rates or trade policies. The idea we'd all put a carbon tax on is, but this energy is a regulated environment. The government can perturb it. So what I've been saying up to now is based on, the current economic conditions we in. That can change overnight.
Mm. Right. And I'll weigh in here too, Larry. And Barry, thanks so much for your question. And we don't even have to go to India for these kind of questions. And in fact, I did some work on rice hulls back in a rice straw with down in Arkansas. One of the biggest rice processing plants in the U.S. is in Stuttgart, Arkansas. But you have similar questions around the corn stover, for example, that Bill mentioned, or soybean hulls, or another, form of biomass. It seems like it's, and as a chemical engineer, and Bill, I'm sure, would agree, we never talk about waste products. We always just refer to undervalued byproducts. I'm trying to figure out, what's the value we can get out of these things? So there's a number of technologies using at these residues. And I would say, the Kieran of 10 years ago, I'd have been all gung-ho, let's look at these crop residues. What can we tear apart? What can we use from them and all the rest of it? But I think something that's becoming more attention is being directed towards is, what are we taking from the land as we do this kind of farming, and what are we going to bring back? And we're looking at conservation agriculture or regenerative agriculture type methods. We'll be looking at, what has left the land in the crops, and should we leave some of these things on the soil? Should we try and incorporate them back into the soil? And that's particularly an issue in some of the developing world, where a lot of those nutrients will leave. So with the rice bran or rice straw, you're going to have a question of, does it make more sense for us, for this community, for example, to convert that into a value-added chemical or fuel? Or should we look at that as a fertilizer soil amendment that needs to bring those nutrients back to the farmland as well? So I think that's a nuance that I probably wasn't as focused on 10 years ago, but definitely, and this is a lot of this is through interactions with researchers at University of Wisconsin and Madison, I'm becoming much more aware of the importance of that as well.
Yeah.
And Larry, can I just pile on? That's a very important point that Kieran makes, because a lot of these people that started these fuel factories and stuff, they said, this is just waste product, and they assumed that waste had zero value or zero cost, and that was just absolutely wrong. First of all, somebody's got to collect that, and that's going to take some money, and it's going to take CO2 emissions to collect it. But more importantly, that carbon that's in that stover or rice hull has value to farmers to help, just what Kieran said, it's so important, and that you can't just assume that that's free. And so once you start saying, that's worth $50 a ton, then all of a sudden the economics gets to be more challenged, but the bigger issue, and it actually has more valuable in the land. The land can use that carbon better and won't waste as much than us trying to convert it into a fuel.
Hmm. Brian from Darlington was just asking the question. He drove by a water treatment plant, and there was an open flame where methane is burning off. Why can't we capture it and use it for energy?
So we absolutely can.
Go ahead, Bill, and I'll follow on.
Okay. That is absolutely something we should do, because just to burn it and have it go up into the air, it has no value. And the bigger issue is when they drill for oil and they have what's called associated gas, and they have a pipeline for oil, but they don't want that gas in there, and so they just flare it. And there's tremendous regulation, because that's just wasteful and adding to the CO2 burden in the country. You can put little turbines or make a little boiler, or if you can't capture it. So the truth is, it's hard to put a compressor and capture. There's probably just not enough being made at that waste treatment plant. But to just burn it is the least useful thing we could do. It's better to burn it and make it into CO2 than let just the methane go up, because methane is way worse for greenhouse gas and global warming. But you could burn it, heat up water, and make electricity, or put it through a little turbine. And so, I mean, that's a very good observation. It's very wasteful. It's just somebody's got to pay the upfront cost to put in a boiler or put in a turbine and turn it into electricity that then you could put back on the grid. And if you're naturally digesting, whether it's human waste or, you know, paper, you're going to emit some of this gas that you could burn. And if we could, it's sort of another way to get a second bite at the apple to use it. And there are landfills that do this. There are places that do it. The downfall is that upfront cost. Somebody's got to put in either electrical generation or some kind of compression unit or some kind of purification unit to do it.
Right. And look, I spent a chunk of my career, again, with a varied path, Larry, to spend a chunk of this visiting sewage plants, trying to figure out a way that we could collect food waste. And instead of having that going to a landfill and generating the methane, which, as Bill rightly points out, is a very potent greenhouse gas, instead trying to figure out, can we capture that? Can we, you know, capture the methane generation in essentially a closed tank, and then use that as a fuel to, you know, produce electricity? And the many of the sewage plants and wastewater treatment plants around the country do that already. There's a significant amount of electricity used in pumping water and, you know, sparging air and so on. So many of these plants will produce their own electricity and often usually export some as well. So it would seem the facility that Brian mentioned, Brian noticed, was either not doing this, or this was from, you know, a secondary or tertiary unit operation where there was a small amount of methane being produced. And as Bill rightly said, it's better to burn that and have it go up as CO2 than to go up as a very potent methane gas. But ideally, we don't want either to go up. And I think here's just one thing I think would be really interesting for your listeners is to think about it. So I spent some time working on this, you know, how do we get food waste out of a landfill and instead into a treatment plant like that where you could capture the methane? Many of the people in the industry thought, oh, aren't we great? We're displacing fossil fuel-derived electricity with our renewable electricity that's coming from, you know, kind of the digestate of essentially human waste and food waste and so on. Well, in fact, the displacement of fossil fuels was a tiny portion of the actual overall greenhouse gas benefit. The biggest benefit was the fact that you no longer had that food rotting in a landfill. And even the best operated landfill in the country, and where they're going to be covering things and trying to capture that methane that is evolving from the rotting organic material, it still will emit an awful lot of methane. So really trying to avoid that methane emission, instead capturing it in a controlled way in a wastewater treatment plant, and using it to produce electricity is a much better use for it. So I think, you know, that's something Wisconsin definitely should think about, is what do we all do with our food waste?
Well, I think we need to have you guys back and talk again. This has been a great discussion. And Bill and Kieran, thank you so much for taking time to be with us. And I hope we have a chance to do this again soon. Thank you.
Oh, good. Well,
thanks, Larry.
The opportunity. Yeah. Thanks. And thanks to your listeners for the questions, too. It was great.
Yeah, Bill Banholzer, research professor and honorary fellow in the chemistry department at UW-Madison, also a senior advisor at the Wisconsin Energy Institute. Karen Furlong, senior fellow at COWS at UW-Madison. great to have both of them with us, and we'll have them back. It was a great discussion, I thought, and we'll continue that discussion down the road. But we're going to start up another discussion and turn our attention to the weather and our weather guys, John Martin and Steve Ackerman. They're with us next. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network.